Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a call by a former Deputy Chief of Staff to Democratic Senate leader Harry Reid for the Democrats to hold the new minority president accountable and to play hardball. We'll begin with Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public policy at Princeton University, who is the author of The Fierce Urgency of Now, Lyndon Johnson, Congress and the Battle for the Great Society, and discuss his article at CNN, What Democrats Should Learn from Republicans. We'll assess President Trump's advice that Senate Republicans should use the nuclear option to get rid of the filibuster if Democrats filibuster his Supreme Court nominee Neil Gorsuch. And with a radical Republican agenda underway threatening transformative changes, will the Democrats borrow from the Republican obstructionist tactics of shutdowns, fiscal cliffs, financial chaos, and procedural warfare to stop an unpopular and divisive president and his unqualified cabinet by playing hardball? Then we'll speak with a 21-year veteran of the United States Senate, Jim Manley, who served as senior advisor to Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid for 6 years, and before that 12 years as an aide to the late Senator Ted Kennedy. He joins us to discuss his former colleague's call for the Democrats to play hardball and offers his insight into whether, because of the cloud of illegitimacy that hangs over the president as investigations into how much Vladimir Putin helped elect Trump continues, the tactic of withholding consent is a viable strategy until a credible investigation either indicts or clears Trump. Then finally, we'll investigate the takeover of national security policy and process by the Trump administration's chief strategist, Stephen Bannon, who appears to have accrued so much power so quickly that he is being seen as the de facto president of the United States. Kate Brennan, the deputy managing editor of Just Security, and a non-resident fellow at the Brent Scowcroft Center on International Security at the Atlantic Council, joins us to discuss her article at Foreign Policy, Steve Bannon is Making Sure There's No White House Paper Trail, Says Intel Source. And joining us now is Julian Zelizer. He's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University and a New America Fellow. His books include Arsenal of Democracy, The Presidency of George W. Bush, Governing America, The Revival of Political History, and his latest book is The Fierce Urgency of Now, Lyndon Johnson and the Battle for the Great Society. And he has an article at CNN, What Democrats Should Learn from Republicans. Welcome to Background Briefing, Julian Zelizer.
Thanks for having me.
So answer the question, if you will, what Democrats should learn from the Republicans. They seem to be in an exquisite fix with the Supreme Court nominee, what to do about that, whether to filibuster or whether to wait to filibuster the next person that might come along. And indeed, they've walked out of a number of confirmation hearings. And of course, the Republicans are basically saying, oh, it's just sour grapes. They're just angry at having lost the elections. But they have... It's almost like battered wife syndrome, you know?
Yeah, I think Democrats tend to be reluctant on Capitol Hill at employing all the tools they have at their disposal. I think when President Obama was in office, they watched as Republicans were incredibly aggressive using the rules of the Senate and the rules available to the House, whether being in the majority and pushing legislation through party line votes or using the filibuster to block President Obama's tactics. And they're seeing the Republicans do it right now once again, as they did when they pushed forward two nominations in the Senate Finance Committee by changing the rules. Democrats don't like to do this. And I think very often they're on the losing end of these congressional battles in recent years. And I think their fears are often greater about what will happen from these kinds of tactics than they need to be. And Republicans have shown you can be very successful politically and achieve policy objectives using the rules of Congress and not simply making speeches or voting on certain bills.
Well, I understand that Mitch McConnell is considered something of a hero amongst Republicans for the stand that he took on refusing to give Judge Merrick Garland a hearing. And now, in retrospect, he's looking like a sage as far as the Republicans are concerned. But
right.
Go ahead.
I mean, there was a lot of controversy when Senator McConnell and the Republicans wouldn't let Garland up for a vote. Many Democrats were extremely critical, and they still are, And now Republicans are calling for a vote on President Trump's nominee, who's very conservative, very much to the right. And what's interesting is early on, there are a lot of Democrats who are hesitant to say they will oppose him, they will tie this up. They're not willing to go where Republicans were. They didn't even have hearings, the Republicans, when Obama was president. But I think what the Republicans showed, as you said, was what happened in the end politically was they now have the nominee they want, and the conditions are right to get him confirmed. And they're even willing to do away with the filibuster, it seems, or there's some evidence that they're willing to do that if the Democrats try to stop them. So again, you see early on this, a lot of Democrats are very hesitant about saying they are going to go into full-throated legislative combat against this nominee for many reasons, while Republicans were happy to do that, and now they have the situation they were hoping for.
Well, President Trump has urged the Republicans to use the nuclear option if the Democrats decide to filibuster his Supreme Court nominee, Neil Gorsuch. So already, and of course, Trump's MO as a businessman has always been to retaliate 100,000-fold. You know, that's his MO. So, but what can you do when Chairman Orrin Hatch of Utah basically pushes through after the Democrats boycotted these hearings on Mnuchin and Tom Price, then he just pushed it through with the absence of any Democrats, broke the rules, and then justified his actions by saying that the Democrats were involved in unprecedented obstruction on the part of our colleagues. I mean, do they have any sense of irony about what McConnell did to Obama and in terms of obstruction, or do they really mean that, or is that just, you know, a convenient kind of hyperbole?
My guess, it's hyperbole. It's posturing. Someone like Orrin Hatch or someone like McConnell, they're very savvy politicians. They know exactly what they did, and they understand that obstruction has been a central tactic. So when they accuse the Democrats of being obstructionists and use that as a justification for getting the rules they want, that's a political move. And that's a case where if Senate Democrats want to be effective, they need to combat that rhetorically. They need to make the case to the public that's not what happened. And they need to do it in persuasive fashion. Nor can they be shaken from continuing to use these kind of tactics. The fact is there's not a lot they can do, but the minority still does have power in the Senate. They can still filibuster legislation, and legislation is coming their way. They can still filibuster the Supreme Court pick, and it's not clear Republicans would employ the nuclear option again. There's some concern about that within the GOP. And they can use other parliamentary tools, like withholding consent on all business, if they really wanted to. That's what Harry Reid's former chief of staff urged them to do in the Washington Post, making life difficult for both the Trump administration and the Senate Republicans. So there are things they can do. Are Democrats willing to do that? That's the million-dollar question. Republicans are, and they're willing to then blame the Democrats for being obstructionist. That's politics. And I think what we're all watching now is how do the Democrats respond, and are they willing to respond in kind?
And again, I'm speaking with Julian Zelizer, who's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University and a New America Fellow. His latest book is The Fierce Urgency of Now, Lyndon Johnson, Congress, and the Battle for the Great Society. And he has an article at CNN, What Democrats Should Learn from Republicans. But if the Republicans are like the bully in the playground and they're just smirking as the wounded Democratic child whines in the corner, what they can't look weak, but on the other hand, how do you deal with bullies? I mean, without becoming a bully yourself, is there a more skillful tactic here?
Well, there is a little bullying, if that's what you want to call it, or there's a little aggression that's needed politically. This is something liberals have struggled with for decades. Back in the 1960s, there were a lot of younger liberals who said that the old Southern Democrats, who were the conservatives at the time and used procedure to block civil rights, that they had to be tougher, that they had to be willing to fight these fights for principle. Otherwise, those principles would die in committee. And I think there is an element today, too, for Democrats where they have to be willing to look ugly. Republicans were willing to do things that didn't make their reputation as a party look very good. Obstruction isn't always desirable, but in the long term, it allowed them to help control the agenda and set up the election of 2016. There's obviously other tactics that can be used. There's the tactic of mobilizing grassroots support. There's the tactic of making brilliant and compelling speeches, both on the floor of the House and Senate, and also on television. But there's a part of it, and historically this has always been true, where you have to get your hands very dirty. And sometimes you need some people on your team, whether it's liberal or Republican, who are ready to look bad in the public eye, but to do that in order to achieve important objectives.
And where do you think, Julian Zelizer, the public are on all of this? I mean, the public, in effect, I think Obama thought somehow that he could thwart McConnell's sort of thuggish behavior, and he didn't. He lost. And he, in his one of his farewell speeches or interviews, he did mention that he was surprised that the American people were not more outraged by McConnell's blockage of Judge Garland. Is there's an old expression, of course, nice guys finish last. Is that becoming a kind of part of our collective cynicism?
Well, you know, Obama had an interesting history in that he started in 2004 with the promise that he would overcome this kind of politics. And he had this strong belief in 2009 that he could convince, he could make a compelling case to Republicans to join him. And the story of his presidency is learning that he overestimated all this. And he understood it posed a danger to democracy, this kind of politics. And he understood it wasn't good for the governing process. But the truth is, by the end of his presidency, Obama had really hardened. He was willing to use executive power aggressively. He was ready to openly attack members of Congress in the GOP and Trump when he was candidate. And he sounded very different than he did in 2004. So you have that farewell speech, but you also have those final years of Obama where in some ways he gave up on his political dream of bipartisan civility. It just wasn't going to happen. And Mitch McConnell was fine with that. I think the Republicans were fine not being liked. They were fine fueling cynicism about government. But in the end, they achieved what they wanted. So I think Republicans are in the same place, and I think the farewell speech has to be packaged with those last few years of Obama that we saw, where he was quite aggressive in going after the Republicans.
But on the very first day of Obama's inauguration, the Republicans met Paul Ryan, Newt Gingrich, McConnell, and they literally plotted his downfall. And their first strategy was, well, we'll take away the one thing that he wants from us and that we can take away, which is his call for bipartisanship. From day one, they decided that they would hang him out to dry on his noble urge for bipartisanship.
Right. And that's harder for Democrats to do right now. I mean, it is possible for Democrats to not give in to bipartisanship, to refuse to cooperate with the administration. If President Trump sends an infrastructure package, for example, which will lead to many people saying you have to join the president in something like this, Democrats can, and some say must, choose to say no, not to give him any victory, you know, force him to obtain any victory that he can get without them, and start to try and exploit divisions within the Republican Party, particularly in the Senate, where only a few votes are necessary for the Republicans to lose their majority. And that's the best strategy. What they have to show, though, is their willingness to employ those kinds of tactics. They no longer have the filibuster on these confirmations, though. And so that's somewhere where Republicans were in much better position in 2009, both on that and on court appointments other than the Supreme Court, and Democrats don't have that power. But Democrats still have a lot of the rest of the minority power that Republicans used before 2010. And so they should force Trump to try to move in their direction rather than vice versa if they really want to be successful as possible in these difficult times.
But do you think, though, that they should hold back on the filibuster of Gorsuch because the next person will be the key one? And the theory is that the reason that Gorsuch was appointed, or one of the reasons, was that he's close to Kennedy, and therefore Kennedy is now free to retire. And so wouldn't the next person be the one that you should save your powder for?
Well, that's a strategic decision. There are some who respond to that saying no. You start filibustering now. That to make this easy will only accelerate both President Trump's willingness to go even further in a rightward direction for the next pick, and it will also change political conditions, meaning if this nomination goes through, as do a lot of these executive orders and maybe legislation that is to come, he will be in an even stronger position when that next pick comes. And so waiting and delay in politics is often a losing strategy. So the response to that would be, no, you filibuster now. And even if it's a losing filibuster, you set up the conditions, really, to fight the next battle more effectively. Obviously, this could lead to, you're making a bet that the Republicans won't jettison the filibuster altogether, and you're hoping some Republicans won't go that far. But I think there is a strong counterargument that waiting at this point is simply allowing President Trump to entrench more support over the next couple months rather than trying to limit that right from the start.
Well, just in closing, Julian Zelizer, there is, of course, something else happening here in the broader zeitgeist, if you will, and that is the spontaneous demonstrations that have occurred with the Women's March the day after the inauguration and the spontaneous demonstrations at the airports in support of Muslims being banned from this country, and many other demonstrations in front of the White House, in front of the Supreme Court, etc. There seems to be a kind of, it's almost as if you've got all this political energy out there in search of a strategy, and I'm sure it's having an effect on the Democrats and the Democratic Party in general, who don't seem to have a strategy, but their grassroots are setting their pants on fire.
I think that's absolutely essential. I mean, we've seen both the grassroots protests that followed the inauguration, the incredible outpouring of opposition that followed the release of the executive order on refugees that was not only protests at airports and in cities, but it also included a mobilization of legal challenges to the president. That combined with some activists on the left through an organization called Indivisible of ex-Democratic staffers who are actually telling people to replicate some of the local tactics that the Tea Party used. All of this in the first week plus has been very important, and I think it's been essential to energizing Senate Democrats and House Democrats. Congress often responds to the electorate, even though we often think of them as this kind of broken branch of government that lives in a bubble in Washington. They watch and they listen. And I think those protests had an effect. The key will be they need to continue the protests. They can't just fizzle out. I think in the end, given the favorable conditions Republicans face right now, those kinds of protests will have to be ongoing if they are going to fuel Senate Democratic and House Democratic opposition on Capitol Hill.
Well, Julian Zelizer, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Julian Zelizer, who's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University and a New America Fellow. His books include Arsenal of Democracy, The Presidency of George W. Bush, Governing America, The Revival of Political History. And his latest book is The Fierce Urgency of Now, Lyndon Johnson, Congress and the Battle for the Great Society. And he has an article at CNN, What Democrats Should Learn from Republicans. We're going to take a brief station break and back discussing this issue further with a 21-year veteran of the Senate who served as a senior advisor to Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid. Thank you. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Jim Manley, who's a senior director at Quinn Gillespie and Associates Public Affairs in Washington, D.C. He's a 21-year veteran of the U.S. Senate and served as a senior advisor to Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid for the past 6 years, and before that served 12 years as an aide to the late Senator Ted Kennedy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jim Manley.
Thanks, as always, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us, Jim. And a colleague of yours, Adam Gentleson, formerly the Deputy Chief of Staff to Senator Harry Reid, has written an article in the Washington Post that's gotten a lot of attention. He's basically saying that we Democrats are inclined to compromise, but if we want to hold this administration accountable, we need to play hardball. And there is obviously a lot of pressure coming from the Democratic grassroots. We seem to be in an odd situation here where you've got a lot of political energy out there we haven't seen before, and but not much strategy. So I've talked to a few politicos in Washington who say, well, we take political energy any day over strategy. So where do you stand on that?
There's something to be said for that, as you're about to find out. It was a very powerful piece by Adam. Let me first of all begin by saying that he fired a shot across the bow that a lot of Democrats in Washington and throughout the country have quickly picked up on. You know, I got to tell you, Ian, as you suggested, I spent 21 years in the Senate. I have great reverence for the Senate as an institution, but I too have come to believe, as you and I have talked about before, that the Senate is broken and something's got to give. And I'm not quite at that point yet, but I think there's something to be said for thinking about stealing a play out of Mitch McConnell's playbook, and that is to blow the place up or burn the place down in order to try and run it against it. And I think more and more Democrats are realizing that this president and this administration and these cabinet secretaries present what I would describe as a clear and present danger to core values that millions of Americans hold very dear. So there's a lot of energy right now, yes, and there is even some strategy about how to deal with this incoming or this administration. There's been a few missteps along the way by some Democrats, but I think more and more folks are beginning to realize that the only way we're going to be able to deal with this administration is by folks hanging together. So we'll see what happens.
Well, it seems like Trump's Achilles heel is that he said, promised his constituents, and I believe that they are 100% behind him, although they at best are about 30% of the country. They hate the press. He plays that card all the time.
Yep.
This is though we're in an alternative universe here. But the one Achilles heel that he has, even with his own ardent supporters, is he sold himself as this incredibly effective businessman. And clearly, so far, they've been completely inept in managing the White House. It's been amateur land, and it's probably going to continue like that. Do you see that as his Achilles heel?
I do, though I'd phrase it slightly differently. Those white working-class voters, those disaffected Democrats that want to rage against the machine, they're going to be awfully disappointed when his cronies at the Treasury Department, at the Department, different agencies, start enacting policies that are going to stick it to the working class of this country. I understand that people are angry, but I'm not quite convinced they're going to support efforts to gut clean air, clean water regulations, to provide billionaires access to the Department of Treasury, and other key departments at the White House. So I think he set himself up. And that is going to be one of his many weaknesses besides his, you know, nasty Twitter habit.
But how do you get to those people, though, and educate them about reality? Because the Trump people have already created this whole environment of fake news and alternative facts. For example, on the first day, the first thing I think, or the second thing that Donald Trump signed as an executive order, was an order that makes it more expensive for working families, working Americans, mm-hmm. to get a mortgage. And that's really fundamental. Yep. That's your ticket into the middle class to buy a house. And he's made it more expensive for the very people that support him. How come that somehow didn't get a lot of attention? For the life of me, I don't know.
Well, a couple of different things. First of all, I must admit that one took me by surprise. Of all the special interest giveaways he was going to start doling out, I had no idea that was at the top of the list. Number two, your specific the answer to your specific question is there's been so much news and chaos since then, it's got bearing. But most importantly, I think we're at a position now that it's not theoretical. You know, we're dealing with this reality, and more folks are going to catch up to it. I mean, let's remember, he's not, you know, he's got record high unapproval ratings, record low approval ratings, wildly unpopular policies, but he's got, key supporters in his base. So it's not like he's the 800-pound gorilla. I mean, he's moving Republicans right now just based solely on this. The fact that they're scared of getting on the wrong side of a tweet storm. So I think that as more and more Americans begin to see exactly what, you know, his policies mean in real-world terms, they're going to start turning off on this guy more and more.
And again,
but right now, it's just a, you know, right now we're just in a situation where, you know, he just floods the zone with news, one outrageous comment after another, one misstep after another, you know. The White House is furiously leaking on each other as we speak. So, you know, I don't envy the press for trying to have to cover this thing. Let me tell you that.
And again, I'm speaking with Jim Manley, who's a senior director at Quinn Gillespie and Associates Public Affairs in Washington, D.C. He's a 21-year veteran of the United States Senate and served as a senior advisor to Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid for the past 6 years, and before that served 12 years as an aide to the late Senator Ted Kennedy. So given that he is not a popular president, he didn't win the popular vote, he's 3 million votes short. He's
yep.
obviously made a big deal about this mythical landslide and these mythical hundreds of thousands of people that showed up at, or didn't show up at his inauguration, etc. It's obviously a very sensitive. I mean, there's a real paradox in this man. He's an insecure narcissist. And my sense is that that's a very good, powerful tool at the Democrats' disposal to question his legitimacy. And also, I think, to build on, as the article by Adam Gettleson in the Washington Post suggests, that Senate Democrats have the power to stop Trump. All they have to do is use it. One of the things that he suggests is that they should use the issue of doubts about Trump's legitimacy because of the Russian interference in the elections.
Mm-hmm.
And that's already in play in terms of an inquiry at the House and Senate Intelligence Committee. I understand that the Trump people have gone to great lengths to try and shut that down, and that may explain why they put political people in at the CIA and at the Director of National Intelligence. So we don't know how robust that inquiry is, but do you think that is a stand that the Democrats can take, as Gettleson is suggesting, that you can basically hold up, gum up the works, throw a spanner in the works, and say, look, only until you guys really have a credible investigation, remove this cloud over the president. Now, it's amazing that Donald Trump does not want to remove the cloud of illegitimacy over him.
Yep.
Because of the Russian connection, which leads you to suspect that there's some substance to it.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. There's a lot to unpack there, unwind there. Obviously, first of all, we begin with the premise that he's clearly rambled about his legitimacy since he keeps on raising the phony idea that 3 million people voted illegally for Hillary Clinton, which, of course, is in and of itself false and or a lie. You know, regarding the Russian thing, I'm not so sure about the tactic of holding it up, holding up nominees over the Russian ties. I mean, after all, the Senate just confirmed Rex Tillerson to be Secretary of Defense. We've already got Secretary of Defense. But this is a very important, but, you know, if Trump thinks that he can quash dissent and quash this kind of investigation, he needs to get his head examined. Well, actually, he does need to get his head examined. Never mind. That's a bad analogy, because there's no way those bureaucrats, those loyal foot soldiers in the different agencies are going to stand and abide by efforts to quash careful review into what exactly happened here. I mean, he and this country are playing with dynamite, quite frankly. There's all sorts of unanswered questions that still yet to be addressed. Trump is clearly rattled by it. You know, who knows where the investigation's going to end up. But I got to tell you, I've had plenty of criticism of the intelligence agencies over the years. But in this particular instance, at this particular time, I'd like to think there's going to be some good, honest folks that are not going to let him shut this thing down.
So in the other tool that your colleague Adam Gentleson is suggesting mm-hmm. that the Democrats use, and that is what McConnell used. He's tied up the Senate when your boss, Harry Reid, was running it, had him jumping through procedural hoops, and he forced a gridlock, forcing Reid to use the cloture process more than 600 times. So why not turn the tables? You know, there is this issue that can gum up the works, and that is unanimous consent. So just explain that to our listeners and how that could be employed.
Sure. Well, we've seen it actually play out in the last couple of days. Little notice or little understood or appreciated sometimes is how much the Senate revolves around unanimous consent. All these routine motions throughout the day that are offered by the majority leader to move legislation forward, to bring the Senate in, to bring the Senate out. You know, the fact of the matter is, you know, they're all debatable motions. And we usually see these kind of tactics in the House, such as demanding a vote on having the Senate adjourn for the night. Rarely happens in the Senate, but they've been doing it for the last couple nights. I mean, to be clear, Ian, McConnell's got a lot of alternatives to try and you know, there are no free shots. McConnell's got a lot of tricks up his sleeve as well, but there's no doubt about it that, you know, Democrats have plenty of tools available to them to come up to work. Our problem has always been that, you know, we believe in good government and good and legislating, and we've been sometimes hesitant to utilize some of these tools. But, you know, hopefully Senate Democrats are going to realize after today that that's probably not a viable option. In the Senate Finance Committee today, my old pal, Senator Hatch, who I know well, he suspended the rules, if you will, and which allowed him to report out two nominees, which Democrats had made very clear they didn't want to have reported out. So, you know, there's again, you know, all this idea of abiding by the customs and the rules of the Senate are being thrown out the window, just like Trump did on the campaign trail. And I think, you know, Democrats are beginning to adjust to this new reality. I understand there are some folks that want to take it a little bit, you know, be a little cautious. But I think a great majority of the caucus is headed towards, you know, demanding a showdown. Again, based on the fact that this man is wildly unqualified to be president.
But how do you explain Orrin Hatch's remarks when he did that, when he let Mnuchin and Price through without having these major questions about
hardball, nothing more, nothing less? He knew that they were going to be. He knew that there were significant questions being raised about both. He knew that the Democrats were going to continue to boycott attending the hearing, thus preventing a quorum until these questions were addressed. And despite the fact that he calls himself an old bull, despite the fact that he loves to cite the fact that he has great reverence for the institution, Republicans do not believe in, you know, the norms, customs, and traditions that, you know, we Democrats do. And so he decided to break the place. And it's you know, too bad, but I got to tell you, Ian, I'm just not surprised, despite all his comments to the contrary. After all, we've got Senator McConnell running around raising questions about why, you know, the Democrats would filibuster Trump's Supreme Court nominee when they made up a rule out of whole cloth that prevented former President Obama's nominee from even getting a hearing in the committee's jurisdiction.
Well, that
was the kind of game they're playing.
Right, but that was what was so breathtaking about what Orrin Hatch said today. He accused the Democrats of being obstructionists, and without irony. I mean, the hypocrisy is breathtaking. Does he really believe that? Does he somehow have selective memory, or is he just being cynical? Is it just because their line, the Republicans' Senate line in the House is, oh, the Democrats are just a bunch of whining children who lost the elections and they can't get over it, you know?
I know Senator Hatch pretty well. I don't believe he, I don't know how to say this except for like this. I don't believe he actually believes what he's saying here. He knows damn well the hypocrisy situation, but he's under orders to move these nominees as quickly as possible, recognizing that they have no idea what kind of bombshells are behind the next news cycle.
Well, at least one of the nominees seems to be collapsing under her own weight of massive inadequacy. And there again, it's because she's a billionaire and she's thrown a lot of money at the Republicans.
Yep.
$200 million.
Betsy DeVos, yep.
Yeah, I mean, the hearings were embarrassing. The fealty
that
people like Johnny Isaacson were showing to her was just beyond embarrassing. But now she's hanging by a thread.
Well, she's hanging by a thread, but close only counts in horseshoes and hand grenades. So we've got two Republican senators against, but if the vice president votes, she's going to be confirmed. So we're waiting to see whether there's going to be one more brave Republican that, again, is going to be willing to challenge this president and get on the wrong side of one of his epic tweet storms. She is, amongst all these nominees, clearly one of the most unqualified, if not the most qualified, for her particular position. As you indicated at the top, I spent 13 years on the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee with Senator Kennedy. I know education policy pretty well, and I find her views completely appalling. But we're, again, two Republicans agree with that sentiment. The question is whether we're going to find the third or not, because there's going to be hell to pay amongst the right. I mean, she's there for a reason, Ian. That was nothing more than a sop to the conservative base that want, God in the schools and private, and vouchers for everybody. So thus destroying the public education system of this country, which she has never had to worry about.
Right, and she more or less came along with the Mike Pence deal. You take Mike Pence, and then you get all the Christian rights votes. But just in closing, though, is there a possibility, though, that you'll find that Senator Sessions, if he is confirmed, then that seat is up, isn't it? I mean, that's empty then, right? And that would...
Well, a couple different things. First of all, leaving that aside for the second, your listeners need to understand that he, despite the fact that he's been nominated to be in Trump's cabinet, he is still voting on the Senate floor for these individual nominees, which I find an appalling breach of decorum, a clear conflict of interest, but it once again demonstrates how these guys just aren't playing by the normal customs and rules. But anyways, that would take a while. I'm sure I don't know the rules in Alabama. I assume that the governor would have a chance to appoint somebody at least temporarily. So we can't hang our hat on that one. We need to find another Republican that's willing to cross Trump.
Well, Jim Manley, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Jim Manley. He's a senior director at Quinn Gillespie & Associates Public Affairs in Washington, D.C. He's a 21-year veteran of the United States Senate and served as a senior advisor to Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid for the past 6 years, and before that served 12 years as an aide to the late Senator Ted Kennedy. We're going to take a brief station break and be back investigating the takeover of national security policy and process by the Trump administration's chief strategist, Stephen Bannon.
It's coming from the field that this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
And joining us now is Kate Brennan, who's the Deputy Managing Editor of Just Security and a non-resident senior fellow at the Brent Scowcroft Center for International Security at the Atlantic Council. Previously, she was a senior reporter covering the Pentagon for Foreign Policy, and she has an article at Just Security and Foreign Policy. Steve Bannon is making sure there's no White House paper trail, says Intel source. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kate Brannon.
Thanks so much for having me.
And already we have the New York Times in its editorial talking about a de facto president, Stephen Bannon. What's going on in that context? Let's start with the extraordinary accrual of power to this person who is a political person. You know, FDR once said that there are two kinds of people you need in politics, those that help you get elected and those that help you govern. And the twain should never meet. But clearly in this case, this is a pretty unusual situation, isn't it?
It is. It's increasingly seeming so, I think, as the details come out about how the White House is organizing itself, how the president is asking for advice on different topics, and who has his ear and who doesn't, and who's the loudest voice in the room. And it sounds like Steve Bannon is right up there. You also hear a lot about his son-in-law, Jared Kushner. My source that I talked to for my story didn't talk so much about Kushner's role, but that behind the scenes, especially on national security, that Bannon is definitely calling the shots. And there was an executive order over the weekend that elevated Bannon to a permanent seat on the Principals Committee of the National Security Council. And this caught a lot of people's eyes because this truly is unprecedented to have sort of your political strategist guaranteed a seat at that meeting. In the past, under President George W. Bush, there was a really strict line that Karl Rove wasn't allowed to attend those meetings. Under Obama, it was a little bit different. There, David Axelrod, Valerie Jarrett, and John Podesta were known to attend those meetings pretty frequently, but they were never guaranteed a seat there, and it wasn't sort of official in writing. So that's one of the big changes that's come out over the last week.
And I believe that in those cases, they were there to observe, but not to speak, and that the principles, I mean, the point is that there are statutory principles on the National Security Council, and in order to make Stephen Bannon a principal, it appears they've knocked off two key people, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs and the director of National Intelligence. And that on the surface is surely what's alarmed a lot of people in the national security community.
I think so. I think it's the sort of demotion of them, the introduction of Bannon to the Principals Committee, and also just Bannon himself and what he represents, his time as CEO at Breitbart, his alignment with the alt-right or far-right, whatever you want to call it. I think it's also, you know, maybe people wouldn't be quite as alarmed if Bannon weren't who he is. But the thing that I learned from my source this week is that regardless of this move to the Principals Committee, he's sort of amassing power behind the scenes in other ways. And by, you know, putting it in paperwork or changing the statute about the NSC, it's legitimizing something that's happening anyway, and that is, he is kind of icing out the National Security Council staff from the normal process. It seems like some of the cabinet secretaries are being left in the dark as they draft these executive orders. So he seemed to be centralizing and making stronger his role in other ways, too.
And again, I'm speaking with Kate Brannon, who's the Deputy Managing Editor of Just Security and a non-resident senior fellow at the Brent Scowcroft Center on International Security at the Atlantic Council. Previously, she was a senior reporter covering the Pentagon for Foreign Policy and has an article at Just Security and Foreign Policy. Steve Bannon is making sure there's no White House paper trail, says Intel source. So the tradition, and it certainly was very much the case under George W. Bush, was that the deliberations of the National Security Council, as they would clear initiatives and policies through the various government departments, heads who affected, as long as they were cleared, they were called summaries of conclusions, or SOCs in government speak. And no such documents are being generated in this secretive manner by Stephen Bannon. People meet with him, and there are apparently nothing on paper. And I suppose it comes down to one of the biggest things that is fought over in, I believe, in the White House is what they call FaceTime. And Stephen Bannon's already won that battle, if you will, hands down, has he not? He has more FaceTime with President Trump, and he also seems to have a lot of influence over the daughter Ivanka and son-in-law Jared Kushner, who I understand are fairly naive and somewhat rely on Stephen Bannon. So in effect, he's got sort of, what would you call it? It's the opposite of double jeopardy, but he's got twice the inroad, if you will.
Yeah. One of the things this source said to me was, you know, the power, I don't think it's that there's no paper being generated. Mm-hmm. He thinks that there may be paper being generated, but it's not being generated by the National Security Council staff. It may, in fact, be generated by Bannon, who may not be recording things accurately or may not be, and he's not circulating it widely enough for people to say, hey, that's not what I said or that's not what we agreed to. And so I thought an interesting thing that this person pointed out was, he who holds the pen sort of holds the authority to shape decisions. You know, Bannon can write the story as he sees fit. And I think right now there are mostly questions around this versus, like, we know that that's what's happening. I think it's more this person who is sort of has a front row seat to all of this doesn't know what's happening, but he knows he's out of the loop and he normally would be in the loop, I think, is part of it.
Right, but we also haven't surely evidence of this procedure or this procedural breakdown in what happened over the so-called Muslim ban. And as far as we know, Stephen Bannon was largely the author of Donald Trump's inauguration speech and the author of almost all of these, or the principal author of all of these executive orders, a flurry of which have been coming out on a daily basis.
Absolutely. And then you have stories that General Kelly at the Department of Homeland Security, he was being briefed on the immigration order the very moment the president was signing it. I read a story today by the AP that General Mattis is particularly incensed by the fact that he didn't see the actual text until, you know, minutes before or in the moment of. It's definitely the other thing that's remarkable about this White House is how leaky it is. I mean, there are so many leaks, and we are getting glimpses of dissent and dissatisfaction across the cabinet. And I think that will continue, especially if Bannon continues to leave them out in the dark.
Well, I suppose one would be speculating about why it's leaking so much, but dissent often is a result of dysfunction. And to some extent, I suppose you can give President Trump the benefit of the doubt since he's a non-politician. But the reports are that he's so detached and so much more interested in how it's almost like an actor wanting to get the first reviews, you know, off Broadway, waiting around at Sardi's at 2 in the morning for the first copy of the New York Times to see what they say about you. I mean, that's my understanding. He spends an awful lot of time watching cable TV, and then he gets mad about the coverage and then tweets about it to the wee hours of the morning. There's already some evidence from what John Kasich's people have said during the campaign that Kasich was offered the vice presidency and all of just about every portfolio that exists, at which point the Kasich people said, well, what is the president going to do? And apparently Donald Trump Jr. said he's going to make America great again. So do we really know about, I mean, is there a reason for Bannon taking over? In other words, he's filling a vacuum?
I think that has to be part of it. I think, like you said, the reports out of the first week, there was an awful lot of TV watching that seems to be happening on Trump's part. But yeah, I don't think he's necessarily interested in the nitty-gritty of governing. And I think he's comfortable. I think he trusts Bannon. That seems pretty clear. He trusts Bannon to kind of carry out his campaign promises, and that seems to be exactly what he's doing.
But normally in campaigns, the purpose of the campaign is to get elected, and I think it's fairly fair to say that a lot of politicians make promises that they don't intend to keep, but that they sound good and they get people motivated to vote. So what's going on here? Is this a exercise in being good to your word at the expense of logic and reason? I mean, in other words, so much of what he promised seemed at the time unrealistic. So why go ahead with unrealistic policies? Do you think that the public would forgive Donald Trump, give him a little latitude if he became more pragmatic? Or I just don't understand why they have this determination to basically enact everything he said on the campaign trail, whether it made sense or not.
I think, well, a lot of the conversations I've been having so far this week, and it is only Tuesday afternoon, which I can't believe,
right.
Are now that it seems clear that Bannon is definitely, you know, running the show with the help of others, but, you know, calling a lot of the shots, what is Bannon's end game? What is this all driving toward? What is it that, you know, it, some of these things are so destructive, whether it's a trade war with Mexico or, you know, weakening NATO and emboldening Russia. Like, what is this all driving at? And I don't think anybody that, I mean, that I've talked to has any clear answers, because it is baffling. Some of this stuff does not appear to be in U.S. interests.
Well, that's led to speculation that perhaps causing chaos is in itself a strategy. And it's often cited that he did, Bannon did an interview, I think, with the Daily Beast a few years back, in which he said that he was borrowing from Vladimir Lenin's idea of tearing the whole system down. I don't know whether he sees himself as a Leninist or not, but he certainly, that quote has come up a lot. Is that a possible explanation?
I think so. I mean, that quote, like I said in my story, is making the rounds. I think it's time to dive in and get inside Bannon's head and figure out what this guy's about. If he's the one in charge, I think he has a lot of very serious, seasoned Washington folks rattled, and I know that that is something that Trump voters, you know, are excited about, you know, being anti-establishment. But I think to some extent this goes beyond this, because it seems like being anti-establishment means being unlawful or being, you know, shaking up the world order, which, you know, I think has people legitimately and reasonably a bit, you know, scared about it, and are trying to figure out what this is all driving toward. And I don't have the answer to this.
Right. Well, but already it's, you know, you can see a kind of a rather looming problem here, and that is that, first of all, the election itself is very tainted by the possible behind-the-scenes role of Vladimir Putin, and that's in itself a cause for major concern. But the TPP, of course, basically removes Obama's pivot to Asia, undoes his signature achievement there, and a lot of people see it in geostrategic terms, that it was more about geostrategy than trade, that essentially the U.S. is ceding Asia-Pacific to China. If we go ahead with the, according to the Russians, the long conversation or the hour-long conversation on Saturday between President Trump and Vladimir Putin, according to the Russians, there was a lot of talk about restoring commercial ties with the United States. Well, the prerequisite for that would be giving up the sanctions. And it's possible that there is an ideology here. I mean, it's a scary prospect that somebody like Bannon, who's already expressed a kind of sympathy for a kind of right-wing authoritarian new global order, and when you think about the despots like Putin, like Erdogan, like Orban in Hungary, like Le Pen, who's rising in France, like Trump's friend Nigel Farage, who engineered the Brexit, if this presidency unilaterally undermines NATO and encourages the breakup of the EU, isn't that an extraordinary gift to Vladimir Putin?
Absolutely. I mean, that's, I think, what he, you know, dreams about. I think, but I also think it's, you know, that alliance that you just laid out for the listeners is a very real prospect. I mean, these are the people that the Trump and the Trump team surround themselves with. Inside the government, some of the people that they've appointed to the National Security Council, from Sebastian Gorka to others who have connections to the far right in Europe. So it's troubling. And I don't think we know where this is headed yet, but it's obviously worth paying attention to. Just a few weeks ago, before he took office, Le Pen visited Trump Tower, and the Trump team tried to, convince journalists that she wasn't there to meet with anybody from the Trump transition team, but that seemed to be kind of bogus. But yeah, these meetings are happening, these relationships are there, and they've got people worried.
Well, just in closing, apparently the National Security Advisor, who a lot of people had concerns about, General Michael Flynn, has been somewhat marginalized and possibly so by Bannon, although there are reports that he's annoyed Trump, the business with his son, propagating the conspiracy theory that Hillary Clinton was running a child sex ring out of a pizza parlor in Georgetown. That apparently annoyed Trump. So that's apparently a part of this overall picture that we're talking about. But in terms of Trump supporters, all of whom I think he's doing a great job and hate the press, and the more he hates, the more the press battles with Trump, the more they believe Trump and the less they believe the press. So you already have those lines are drawn. But the other part of Trump's promise was, of course, that he was a competent businessman and he'd run America like a well-oiled machine. And that is certainly not what's happening. So just at the end of the day, do you think that is his real Achilles heel?
That they're inept?
Yes, to put it bluntly.
I think it could be. Yeah, but, you know, as I talk to people, there are sort of, you know, they look at the ideology of Trump and the people around him that's very troubling and what we've talked about so far, and then they look at this ineptitude, like the fact that they're not documenting their meetings and they don't have an organizational chart yet for the National Security Council, and, you know, they're not properly vetting these executive orders and they're not getting lawyers to look at them and they're rolling them out in this kind of slapdash fashion, and it does look chaotic and inept. But that seems as troubling. Like, people don't know which is more troubling, sort of the ideology that could be leaning far, you know, this white nationalism and all this stuff, or is it actually that we have somebody who's completely inept running the U.S. government? And I think that both things, some people might find solace in the fact that they seem somewhat inept. I think it's also kind of a dangerous situation.
Well, Kate Brennan, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks so much.
And again, I've been speaking with Kate Brennan, who is the Deputy Managing Editor of Just Security and a non-resident senior fellow at the Brent Scowcroft Center for International Security at the Atlantic Council. And previously, she was a senior reporter covering the Pentagon for foreign policy. And she has an article at Just Security and Foreign Policy, Steve Bannon is Making Sure There's No White House Paper Trail, Says Intel Source. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time.